This is Tom Gross, Coffee with Kenobi news guy, and you are listening to the Rebel Base Card Podcast. Great pull, kid.
Only watch your step. This place can be a little rough.
You found something.
You found the Rebel Base Card Podcast.
What a piece of junk.
I'm your host, Greg McLaughlin.
He's as clumsy as he is stupid.
Join me as we discuss Star Wars trading cards and card collecting.
We need a statement, not a manifesto.
We'll talk about sets from the original vintage.
No, the one I'm pointing to.
All the way to current releases.
This?
Yes.
All right, let's get started.
Commence primary ignition.
Welcome back, or if this is your first episode, welcome aboard. My name is Greg McLaughlin, and this is the Rebel Base Card Podcast. Hailing from Naples, Florida, Daniel Riverone is a sketch card artist for Topps, Upper Deck, and Cryptozoic, as well as a middle school art teacher, husband, and father. The only way he keeps on top of things is to have great time management and artistic skills. Like many artists, I come across his work on Instagram, and he showcases a very distinctive grayscale style. We had a great conversation that you'll hear tonight in a few minutes, but let me get a little homestead keeping out of the way first.
You can waste time with your friends when your chores are done. Now, come on, get to it.
All right, I do want to keep the homestead keeping notes light tonight because I want to get you into the interview, but there's a few things I just wanted to go over. One is, this is episode 75, and amazingly enough, you know, I always think some of these numbers are great. Then you go look at some of the ones I subscribe to and they're in the hundreds and you go, okay, 75, it's nice, but you got a little work to do before you catch up to some of the others. But it's a nice milestone to hit sometimes when you hit these numbers. And, you know, at some point, you know, you kind of want to get to that podcast where, you know, the numbers are just there for indexing, but you're already an established show. And you know, we've been going now for... You know, it'll be coming up on 2 years in March, and so we're over that year and a half hump. We're getting towards the end of the year. I know that I've got some people I still need to talk to. The list just keeps on going. I know that just like last year, my intentions are about mid-December last year, I kind of put the brakes on a little bit to kind of enjoy the holidays. And of course, everybody else is out and about. And so sometimes like when you're doing these around this, you know, a little later on in the year when you're getting to the holidays where people's schedules are a bit disruptive. I mean, all of 2020 is disruptive. What am I saying? But you do kind of like, you know, people are doing holidays and so maybe their schedule isn't so much. So, you know, like towards the end of the year, it's a nice little shutdown time. So, you know, I'm starting to kind of tick down to the number of episodes I have before the end of the year. And then, of course, when we get into 2021, one thing you'll notice is that the podcast border art, which this year was red for series two, the original 1977, I'll be having to get to work on that actually. But I'm going to be going with the, series three yellow border. So stuff that shows that we do in 2021, just kind of following along that classic 77 Topps, we'll have that flavor. So kind of excited to kind of see that as we've gotten through most of 2020. And I think like everybody else, we are really wanting 2020 to end very, very soon. So once again, keep safe out there. Do what you need to do. Masks, social distancing, all that kind of stuff. Because we're not out of the woods yet, folks. And we've got a little ways of this to go, and I want to make sure that all of you are around next year to listen to me ramble on for yet another year of the podcast. Recently, I had a chance to see Empire Strikes Back in the theaters, and you know, and as I'm checking the AMC app, it's not as many screens, but it's still out there. If you haven't had a chance to see it, you know, the theaters have done a great job of, you know, implementing a lot of ways to keep you safe. I took my daughter, we saw it, and there was like six people in this whole theater, and that included us. You know, they cleaned off everything, and let me tell you, I felt safe, but also it was so good not only to go back into a theater, but to see Empire Strikes Back on the big screen. And the last time I saw it was when the special editions came out in the late 90s, and so it's been, you know, over 20 years. Since I've seen it in the theater. And one thing, you know, like you, I've seen Empire numerous times. I don't even keep count anymore. But, you know, what I enjoy is you go back up there and you see it on a large screen. And a lot of people have, you know, big TVs and so forth. But I was seeing details that you kind of forget about. And what's nice is your eyes tend to go, you know, to the corners, to the edges, and you're seeing, oh, there's that droid, or there's that creature. There's Wilro Hood, you know, running with the ice cream maker. And some of the things you just kind of enjoy. And, you know, Empire, of course, you know, when George Lucas went back and did the special editions, you know, it didn't get as much treatment as Star Wars had. So there's a little, you know, although there's a lot of Bespin and so forth that was done, and I'm very happy with it. I don't really have too much of a problem with Empire. But, you know, to see some of those scenes again, from the battles on Hoth to enjoying the time, you know, Luke and Yoda, the asteroid field, you know, chase, you know, watching Darth Vader, all those classic lines, it was so enjoyable. And what was funny is the AMC, my AMC still had some of those, the Rise of Skywalker, you know, R2-D2 popcorn tin and, you know, drink holder. It's a huge piece of plastic. It's about at least 2 feet tall. And, you know, R2's lid was the, you know, was the place you could put a drink. And there was a room for a straw there if you wanted to do. And the body of R2-D2 was a place you could put popcorn. And he has a little back compartment you can reach in there. You know, like a good collector, I had the popcorn. It was part of a combo. And, you know, it was like $30. And I think someone reminded me on either Instagram or Twitter that when it came out, I think it was $50. And so $30, for $50, I was like, no, I can't bring this big hunk of plastic home. My wife is going to kill me. For $30, I made a compromise with myself, going, all right, we're just going to have to hide this somewhere. So shh, keep it quiet. But, you know, it was fun to kind of sit there and, you know, we just enjoyed the show. It was fun picking up a huge collectible that I did find a space for in my kids' room. Which is where all the toys go to, and cards went to hide for a while, until they learn to clean up the room. Then Daddy's in a lot of trouble because he's got to find another place for this stuff. So that's the burden of all Jedi masters and collectors, at any rate. But if you get a chance to see it, do yourself a favor, go see it. I do not think you will regret going. I think you're going to be safe. You know, everybody's got to wear a mask in there, but the theaters need help. Help right now, and at the very least, and I think it was like $5 a ticket. So I mean, like, come on, do yourself a favor, go see it while it's still out there. Whether you're doing drive-ins, whether you're doing theaters, enjoy Empire Strikes Back. Enjoy seeing the huge screen and all the sounds and all that kind of stuff. You won't regret it. Of course, we have Mandalorian Season 1 cards that are coming as we get closer and closer to the debut of Season 2 of The Mandalorian on October 30th. And the cards are set to come out on the 4th. Most places are still out of the pre-orders. I do need to check back because I did do a pre-order of some blaster boxes from Steel City Collectibles. Can't wait to see those cards. And also can't wait to see what the Star Wars Card Trader is doing for The Mandalorian. And if they're also going to do the weekly sets on Tops Online. I'm already in for the living set. And Chris Penix has been still killing it. I think he's up to like 150 now. What a great set, and, you know, definitely a way to, if you can save up some lunch money, those living set cards, you won't regret them. Those are also, he's just been killing it, and what a great set that's turning out to be. Speaking of Card Trader, a couple items. Mark and Gabby on the Digicast just a couple days ago, they released an article that they are, you know, one of the things, if you've been in Star Wars Card Trader for a while, you've probably heard about monuments. And if you haven't heard about monuments, you certainly have heard people or seen people in the feed talk about hoarding a character. This is where you are collecting a certain character from a certain set. You know, like if you hear me talk, I hoard Commander Pyre, and I am not on the level of some of these hoarders where they go out and they actively are searching for people and they will trade X amount and they'll try to get as many of the cards of that person as possible. And one of the reasons, and it was something that kind of grew organically within the app years ago, where people were just kind of collecting as many of a particular card as they can, is that there's been on and off monument chases where if you got X number of cards, you could turn them in and get a card, and it would have your username on it. It's a monument card, it'd be unique. So basically, you get in the app with a unique card. I know that there's been a lot since the new builds have come out, and there was some changes in Tops folks. You know, this topic has come up a lot where, okay, how are we going to handle monuments? When are monuments coming back? monuments, monuments, monuments. So during the Digicast, and they do this on Twitch, they'll announce times in the Star Wars Card Trader app news when they go on the Digicast. I subscribe to Twitch, to their Twitch channel, and get the notifications so I can see when they go live. And I just happened to catch this one where they were talking about they released the new stats or the new stat requirements for monuments for next year, and I think some for this year as well. I recommend going into the Card Trader app and reading, but the big line is that they did increase the number based on the cards that were already out there. So you're probably looking at 20,000, like the tier one type cards, and that's kind of the beginning. And so it looks like you're going to have to collect a certain number of each of those tiers of a particular card in order to do the workshop meld for a monument. And I think the workshop, if I'm not mistaken, I'll have to go back to the article. I think that comes out in the first part of next year, where they're going to have the whole mechanism to meld a hoard. So if that's something you like, and I know one of the nice things about Star Wars Card Trader is that you can kind of collect, just like in the physical world, you can collect many different ways. And some people are really serious about hoarding, and you can always, one of the podcasts I do enjoy listening to is the Hoardcast, where they do, those folks are all about the hoarding. And, you know, it's a different way to play, but it's fun, and I think it kind of keeps things going. So when a new base series comes out, for those of you who might be interested in this kind of chase, that's a good time to get in. You can always take a character and just try to hoard as much as you can, but I would say when a new base series comes out, and we can't be that far away from next year's base, usually because it comes out around this time. I know we were in like wave two, and I think I'm just about done with some of the lower tiers. I know there's been some variants come out, and some of them I've been, some of them I get, some I haven't been that serious about it just because there's other things, including that Return of the Jedi, the physical set that was in there, and so I've been collecting that digitally, and some of the other ones. There's been some good sets, and so the dual perspectives has been really nice, and the armored and ready, and so forth. So if you're not in there, I'm in there as Corn-Fed Tech. I know that say that a lot. And if you're on Twitter, Card Squadron is a hashtag I use, and there's a group of folks that are also in the app, and we are a good group of folks that do some healthy trading. So if it's something you've been wanting to check out, Star Wars Card Trader is fun. There is a free-to-play aspect to it. Some of us get in a little deeper, but you can still do free-to-play, and especially if you have folks to trade with, makes it a lot funner, and I invite you to join us. We have a blast, and some shout-outs to the rest of the Card Squadron out there. You guys make it fun for me, so more power to you, and good luck on your pulls. I think that takes care of all the homestead keeping I wanted it to do tonight, so let's get into the interview, and I'll catch you on the other side.
If they don't go for this, we're going to have to get out of here pretty quick, Chewie.
If I'm saying Riverin, am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's a way to say it. Riveron. I've gotten Riverin. I've gotten Riveron. I've got Rivero before.
What is it? What is it, though?
Riveron. In Spanish, it's Riverón, but I don't ever get that. I only get that with my grandparents. But yeah, I have a Cuban background. So my parents and my grandparents are from Cuba. I'm the first of my family born in the States.
Oh my gosh!
I have the heaviest, you know, accent in terms of, you know, English. So when I talk Spanish, it sounds like someone that's never talked Spanish before trying to speak Spanish. That's how they make fun of me for it. The irony is that my grandfather's been in this country over 50 years now. And he hasn't even tried to learn English, but yet it's disrespectful for me to not speak Spanish appropriately. So we get into those kind of, like, not arguments, but, you know, I say my point, then he says his point, then it's dropped.
Oh, my goodness.
He just turned 90 Tuesday.
So he would have been of that Cuban generation that left Cuba for that particular reason, right?
He left knowing it wasn't going to be well, and he got... And he came, he didn't come like by a boat like all everyone's. He actually got a visa and then got a work visa and was working for a full year, I think 2 years before he got his citizenship. And then since my dad was also born in Cuba, he got his citizenship the same time that his parents got citizenship. Oh, wow. So So they, it was a different, now it's harder to get, but back then it wasn't as hard. So they got it pretty quickly and they've been here ever since, but it was all in Miami. And then by the 1989 is when I was born in Miami. So we moved here to Naples. My dad saw it as a place that's growing and that's going to flourish. And he wanted to start a business here. And sure enough, he started his business here and we haven't left since. So it's, I like Naples. It's one of those black holes is what I call it. You will leave Naples, but you always end up coming right back. Like a whirlpool. Just, yeah, you can go as far as you want. Eventually, you can't find anything better and you come right back here.
What did your grandfather do when he got to the States for work?
Oh, he was a driver. Yeah, he worked for a trucking company, dispatching. So he would be the guy that the dispatch would call him. Hey, go to Tampa, pick up a load and bring it back to Miami for a building, you know. So he's one of those. And then my dad saw that growing up, liked it, learned it, and he got his GED from high school, got married young, had me, then started working for his father in those companies, then learned enough to start a company here in Naples in 1990, and then went from there. Oh, wow. He still works. My dad's one of the hardest working people I've ever met in my life. He would wake up at 4 a.m. because truck drivers have to get up early to get to a certain location and back in time. So 4 a.m, he was up every morning and I wouldn't see him till like almost 9, 10 o'clock at night every day for a brief period. So it was like the time that I can remember as a kid, 4 or 5-ish around there. I wouldn't see my dad all day except for the, you know, Sunday because he didn't work Sundays. And then by the time I was 15, now he's now becoming a dispatcher where he's not driving the truck. He's telling people where to go. Mm-hmm. And then he started up at least 2 or 3 companies until he said, finally, he's like, I'm done. He's watching the grandkids now. He's, you know, he had my kids for a couple years with my mom. And then now it's, they're with my in-laws while my sister has a kid and they're watching him, you know, while we're at work. So we got lucky in the sense that we have someone to watch the kids instead of paying these astronomical numbers at these daycare places. And they're savvy enough because my mother-in-law, she used to be a teacher in Collier County Public Schools as well. She just retired. So what better way to have our kids doing online schooling than with her? So she'll do a little bit with them in the morning. Then we take over when we get them at night for this COVID crisis. And it's been, we got really lucky. And it's been, you know, a blessing to have my in-laws about 7 minutes away from our house. And then my parents, right? You're going to love this one. Have you ever seen Everyone Loves Raymond?
Yeah.
My parents are literally across the street. I can walk to them. And then next door is my grandfather.
Oh, my goodness.
4 houses down from them to the, if you're facing them to the right, it's my sister. We're all in the same. The only ones that's not in our street is our in-laws. My in-laws. They're not in our commune, if you know what I mean.
Oh, that's funny.
But they on my way to work, since I work about 6 minutes away, I drop the girls off at my in-laws, and then I just head to work. About, you know, from their house is about 2 minutes from their house. So all our school districts are, if you find a place to live and you can get into a school that's close to your house, it's a breeze over here. Now, if I'm here in my, where I'm at in the Estates, and I have to go all the way to Mockley or to Manatee or something, like that, now we're talking like a 45-minute, you know, drive or anything like that. But my wife, her job is literally 2 minutes away from here. And so she goes to her school there. And now that once the COVID crisis is done, she will be able to take both kids because now one's in kinder, the other's in first, take them with her. And then the grandparents finally get their break.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
No, we lucked out, man. It's a blessing for sure.
How long have you been an art teacher?
This will be my 7th year total.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming you went to school for art and or teaching, or is this just you were assigned like you're going to be the art teacher?
No, one of those things. I've been in the district honestly 19 years total. I started when I was 17, and then I've been with it ever since. And I try to work my way up money wise, and then finally I just got my degree in whatever. Like I got it in communications, honestly. And in Florida, you can be a teacher as long as you get a degree in something and then take the tests. So my first option was art because I've always enjoyed art history. and I've always enjoyed drawing in class, and I read a lot of comic books, and you know, so I was a typical geek in school, but it was like a hidden geek. Like, not a lot of people knew that I had like a plethora of comic books in my house. It was only like let's say a day camp came over, it's like, you have a lot of comic books. Yeah. But I went in that direction. It was actually because of my principal at the time that I was working with. He told me that he went to Backway, and I did the same thing, and I ended up becoming a teacher within 2.5 years. I got my degree in 2.5 years through a private school here, and that was it.
Oh, that's cool.
Nothing really special. I mean, I don't have like a huge art background, sorry, except for the fact that I'm a huge fan, and I've been drawing ever since. Now, the story of how I started drawing for these companies is my students, actually. One of my kids went to a comic convention, Florida SuperCon. That happens in Miami in July every year, except for this past year. I think they even changed the schedule for last year to be in June during this COVID crisis. One of the kids went there, and I've been drawing sketch cards in my classroom, giving them as prizes.
Oh, that's first.
Nice. This is like I'd say about 4 years ago. And one of those kids kept my drawings, and they took it with them to a convention to get someone to sign it for them, because one of those comic creators that are there. And she came back, and she's like, you know, you can draw better than some of those people that are there. I'm like, oh, no, thank you, but no. And they kept pressing. And then she told her friends. Then those kids kind of banded together to kind of like, you should sign up. Here's the website to sign up for. And next thing you know, and I said, if you, you know, do you work, you know, and I want your best work, you give me your best work, then I'll sign up. And within like 3 months, they gave me their work. Fantastic. I had to make a banner. I went into full like artist mode for like 2 months straight, drawing a new piece every day. And that's including sketch cards. I had a book this thick full of sketch cards at that point. I had paintings and 9x12s in my style. I really figured out my style at that point, because I got tired of cutting with X-Acto knives, because I used to spray paint like graffiti work. And I really got tired with the cutting. Hold on, honey. That's my daughter. I was tired with cutting everything. I said, oh, I wonder if I could just draw it instead. And then that's how it started from there. And these are all the 9x12s that I've been on. And I still, every day, been doing it. And now that I'm contracted with Tops and stuff, it's more like I do that work, and then I do stuff for me, and I sell those on the side. And I've been doing it ever since. I went to every convention ever since then. I kind of got the bug. So I go and I have a great time, and I even do some local stuff here. But the last 2.5 years have been really busy with Tops, Upper Deck. And so it's one of those things that, and they're all different too, which is great, because Tops, they want likenesses, and that's my thing. I like likenesses. And Upper Deck, they want comic book versions. So they don't have the rights, and I still don't understand how they don't have the rights to likenesses, but yet Topps does, because they're all under Disney at some point. They're under this umbrella under Disney.
I've heard that on the Marvel Card Collectors podcast, where they talk about likenesses versus just the characters themselves. And so, yeah, it is sort of an interesting minefield to kind of walk around, because I think after a while, you start to see Tony Stark as, you know, Robert Downey Jr. And so if you're doing, or something along those lines, where you're just like, oh, so it's probably hard not to. You're probably like, well, I got to go back to the comic books now and kind of do that.
Mm-hmm. And so it's actually good for me, because then it takes me away from likenesses for a little bit. And then I get really into art. So it's purely original. If I look at references just to see what the costume looks like, and then go from there. So references for likenesses are easy to find. And then to get approval from Tops, you know, sometimes they send us some references, especially Cryptozoa. Cryptozoa gave me like a file like this big for their last line, which I don't even know if I'm allowed to say what they're releasing yet. But I finished that set 2 weeks ago. And now right after I finished that set, then Tops came back with another one. So everyone knows that Masterworks are now available. So working on these now, and it's just constant work. So it's every, like, I feel like I get like a gap in between where it's like 2 or 3 months, And then all of a sudden I get one. And then after I sign one contract, then it's like 2 weeks later, another contract, then another contract, then another contract. So it works that way. And it depends on the time of the year too. So it's always slow for me, January to March. And then all of a sudden March picks up. And then June, by June in the summer, I'll get two sets. And then it really gets heavy right before Halloween. For some reason, this time of the year, I'll have, like, I finished a Mandalorian set. I finished a Star Wars set before that. Mm-hmm. I finished the Zoic set. And now I'm working on MasterCard. And I just got I signed a contract for Upper Deck for their latest set that's coming out. Our deadline's in March, but I don't know. Usually when I send the cards in by the deadline, usually about 2 or 3 months until they actually release the set.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know Upper Deck and their sets, especially on their Marvel sets, you know, they have a completely different timeline than Tops. And so, like, a product, you know, and I'll, like I said, I defer to the Marvel Card Collectors podcast, which, you know, at some point, if you haven't been on already, you should be on. Yeah, like a set, like a 2017, like you'll see on their EPAC, like their 2017 like annual or some of that stuff is still current, as opposed to like Tops, which will do half a dozen seven sets a year. But it's like you go from boom boom, like we should actually have been in Holocron. That was the last one that should have been out, but really Chrome Legacy was there. But once we, you know, in a couple of weeks when we're getting into Mandalorian, then you know, Chrome Perspectives will be old hat, and then Holocron comes afterwards, and it's going to drop theoretically about the same time that Masterwork does.
Yeah.
But you know, if you've worked on Masterwork before, you're talking about completely different kinds of sets. You were showing, you know, I've seen also Rodney Roberts was showing like some of the blanks, and you could see like you have the booklet type. And mm-hmm. then the bifolds, or if you had trifolds or something like that. So you've got this, you know, you've got this interesting mix, but you know, a lot of those ones on the autograph side for Masterwork are autograph on cards and thicker cards. So you've got a different card stock. So, you know, it's built for a much higher end collector, and it will cost appropriately. So,
correct.
You know, correct. So I think you have to say, like, you know, when you're going into each set, you have a lot of different factors to think about.
Mm-hmm. So far, my favorite card stock between any of the companies is been Topps Masterworks and Cryptozoic, because they're the thicker set and they actually hold watercolor very well in some of those, whereas everything else is just so thin. So I feel like that for me personally, I felt like to get to Masterwork, this is my first Masterwork set. I felt like I had to prove to myself to get to that level in terms of likenesses, because that's what they're really looking for in these sets. I've missed out on the black and white ones. I would have loved to do that one, but it's almost like they pick and choose based off what comes in, and then they say, oh yeah, this person will work good for this, this person will work good for that. But communication between me and them is, you know, the only communication I get, you ready for this set, yes or no, and then yes or no, and that's it. And communication with Upper Deck, same thing. Cryptozoic was the only one that I would actually send messages and they would respond with answers, which was nice because they only do like four, I think I heard four sets in the whole year, if that. So with that, I guess that they have time to communicate with all their artists at that point. Whereas Tops, forget it. Upper Deck, forget it. I just, if I want to get the job, I'll say yes. They'll send it to me. I ship it back. But it's been a great whirlwind. I get to show my kids, you know, like I can't draw that in front of them because I feel like I'm going to break the NDA if I do that. But I get so tempted because I want to get them done and I can do my work while they're doing their paintings and things. But you know, sometimes I can, like, you know, if you guys don't say anything, here's a quick, you know, I do like a quick flash and then.
And it has to also be, I think, and not necessarily playing favorites of, you know, brands, but I have to think, and I don't talk a lot about, you know, like say, you know, Cryptozoic or Upper Deck or Rittenhouse or whoever is, you know, I think the art directors and the producers behind those sets, you know, they are kind of, you know, I think probably have a better idea of how they're crafting, you know, because crafting the artist or selecting the pool of artists for the set. Now, granted, there's going to be a percentage that that person is not available or that person, you know. But right. I have to think that if I'm an art director and I really kind of know my snuff, then I can kind of go, well, this set probably, you know, the characters who I have in my head probably lend themselves to, you know, artists, you know, 12 through 36, as opposed to this one who this person does probably a better job at this one and that one. I have to think that that's how the process goes.
Do you collect them? Do you actually have a nice set, like a collection of the cards?
I started collecting again back in 2015 with the Journey to the Force Awakens cards, and I started off with one binder, and then now I have about 20. I've actually started archiving. It's the sketch cards that have come to mean the greatest, education for me, because you start off and I'm like, I'm thinking like, oh, autographs, because when I first started collecting, there were no autographs. And you kind of go, oh, that's what you want. Like, what is a sketch card business? And then afterwards you start going into, oh, wow, these are harder to find. These are, you know, and you see how they have progressed from turn of the millennium, where, you know, some of the early ones literally are just sketches. And now I think that most folks I talk to, they prefer, and it's very appropriate to call them art cards.
Yes.
I've only really pulled one. I've bought a few, but I've only really pulled one that was a Kelly Baber. I did a show, you know, back earlier part of the year when I pulled one of his trifold ones, and then sold it to a friend of his who was a big collector of those. Mac, who's a big collector of his of Baber's work, I'm like, that's not mine, it's yours. But so yeah, I think and some of my friends online who are collectors, you know, it's the sketch cards really that are the hard sought ones.
Yeah, I've never pulled one. What's great about being in the sketch card community is that every one of them, unless they're extremely busy, are so friendly. So friendly. I can name two guys right now. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have even gotten into Upper Deck. Mike Seeley, he's an Upper Deck artist. And Nostratep Art, which is Peterson spelt backwards. Yeah, he's done a few sketch cards for Cryptozoic and Upper Deck. And those guys are the ones, like, I met them in conventions. Call these people and email these people. And but in terms of getting the cards themselves, opening them in a pack, we just trade. I actually trade with those artists, and that's why they're so nice and why I enjoy the community. My sketch card collection of other artists is just, it's this thick now because of the last 3 years of just trading, you know, my work for their work and things like that. And it's been fantastic. And I haven't bought a pack in years. And I've always wanted to buy one and have that dream to open, and one of mine is in there. But the odds of that are just to find one. Imagine trying to find mine. I find more of mine on eBay than I would, you know, in a pack. And you know, but the collections, like I was collecting autographs before I did all this too. I was one of those through the mail autograph collectors. Where I see if I get lucky and they sign it. And the only problem with that is you don't know if it's them or their secretary that signs them. So it's like, you know, so I stopped doing that a while ago, and then all of a sudden this just boomed with the sketch cards, and then I just continued with that. And I love it. Like I've never had this in my desk before. It's just like an art studio on my desk. I have an art studio at my work, and it makes the day go by fast, which is nice, especially when you're a teacher and you got, you know, 25 kids or close to 30 kids in one sitting, and you know, every period, and you gotta have that classroom management. But they're interested in what you're doing. So when I do these 9x12 paintings and things like that, yeah, they actually just sit there and watch me paint. I have it on a overhead, and let's say if we're doing like Greek art, you know, ancient Roman and Greek art, I'll do the same work with them, and they see my process, and then they're learning from me, ask me questions of why I'm doing this and why am I thinking about doing this. And then next thing you know, I look at theirs and they come up with stuff completely backwards from mine, but looks better than mine. it's just one of those things that if it wasn't for the sketch card artwork, my job as an art teacher, even though it's great, it wouldn't be as fun, I think, because it brings out the best in me and it brings out the best in my students too, especially for the sets that, like, I print my own cards, you know, for the sake of selling my own work. And it really started out as me like doing portraits for other people and their families. And then sometimes I get the occasional, hey, can you draw Spider-Man? Like, I don't know if I could do that and sell that. You know, I don't want to get in trouble. But I created my own for the conventions as well. So I made something like this. So I draw these for the kids on these simple cardstock, and they'll like, let's say for an essential question of the day, I ask questions every day, you know, about the specific subject we're on. And Mr. Irvine, can you, you know, they'll get the answer right. And then, can you draw this for me? And since it's free, I just draw whatever they want me to draw for free. Because it's my students and they're worth it. You know, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be in this, you know, industry with the cards.
That brings up an interesting side question. Whereas I think maybe an art teacher or say a music teacher, where students can physically see the chops, right? Opposed to, let's say, an English or a history teacher, maybe math too, where, you know, like an English or history teacher, you know, you have to, you tell them I have read X, Y, and Z, but kids can't see you read, you know, they're but they can literally see you do this. And I think that really, for the kids who really are wanting to, or are into it, that mm-hmm. must just bridge a gap that you that other teachers maybe not have.
I never had an art teacher that I think I had one, but she would paint, like she'll start and we never see her going through the process. And then the next day we come back in class and it's done. And I never really see the person work. So I never had an art teacher that would actually show me step by step. And that actually bothered me as a student. And even in college, when I did take college courses, I did, you know, just to have that, you know, that fun part for me in college, I took, you know, three courses in art and figure drawing as well. And even those teachers didn't even show us their process. So it's like, I always thought that as a teacher, I need to show my students how at least I do it. And if they could pick up at least a little bit and then put it into their work, then I did my job. You know, it's very important to me that they see it. And if they don't see it, then I feel like I'm not doing anything for them. You know, they could, it's almost like being like you said in math, you know, yeah, kids can get it, but are they going to retain it? You know, like, I mean, I still have a hard time doing Pythagorean theorem, you know, out of the top of my head. These kids are coming in, they're doing it now, but they're going to lose it by the time they walk out of that door and going into summer break. You know, it's one of those things that at least that if I draw and then they get a chance to keep it. That's the cool thing. Like I don't sell to the kids. They just, you know, they just, and they get a roll. Like I have like a whole table full of them, you know, like I'll have a little brief moment. I'll draw a 5-minute quick sketch and I'll work in like a pace that I work at a comic convention. I don't know if you've seen Jim Lee, how quick he draws his Sharpie pens and all that. Same thing. Answer the question, pick what you want or ask me what you want.
But yeah, when you're saying basically that, you know, kids can see the work. Kids can see you go through the work. But also I'm wondering, in recent events, not to drag too much into it, but how much school time have you had during these pandemic months?
So I started, we started almost a month late. So we had the heads up, you know, the district supervisors decided to extend the start date of our district. So it was about a month, and then from there, they were going through the CDC guidelines based off of what our state was going through. So there were three options. So they had a choice to come to school or do online while blended with classes. So there'll be a teacher with kids plus online kids at the same time, which that's very difficult. You know, I'm asynchronous, so I have students live with me. But my kids online, they don't have to sign in at the same time as my live student. They go in, since I'm an elective, they can go in any time as long as they get the work in by 11:59 p.m. before the next day. So, and that even that is a struggle. I I have about close to 170 kids, so we have to make sure that we micromanage all that. And then the third option is they do a direct online class through our online district schooling that we have here. So they have their choices, and it's great to have the choices, honestly. I'd rather be in the classroom, honestly, even though I'm a high risk as well. I'm a type 1 diabetic, so I wear an insulin pump here. So I have to watch. I had to build my own acrylic glass thing on my desk. So they see me, but it's like a piece of glass is separating between me and the kids. I don't like it because I don't get to walk around and see their work as much. And we're not passing things out. And in terms of them, me grading their work, they're literally sending it to me through the online courses that we have. So I get it digitally. So I, when I grade, I'm looking through my phone and grading all the work through my phone. And then I have my computers to actually match all the grades. It takes longer to grade, but it's better for me in terms of being, you know, not being in contact physically with the students.
How, outside of the logistics of what you just described, though, how have you changed, or what things have you noticed that you could change that still kind of gets through to them or gets the root to the message of what you're trying to, you know, like, put them along on, or you're trying to bring them along on? How have you kind of tweaked that a bit?
Just making the content exciting. As long as I have strong classroom management. The thing is, online, I can't control as well, obviously, in the classroom because they don't see me. So I made sure that it's a structured, you know, schedule that I have. They'll average about two assignments a week because it takes 3 days to get one assignment done, maybe two at the least. And then a quiz per assignment. And then I give them a specific due date. And then, you know, I get at least, I don't know the exact percentage, but it's up past in the 60s. You know, not all of them, you know, make it on time. Sometimes they have technical issues too. So I have to be lenient with those kids at home. But in class, I have my classroom management set. I learned early on working through the schools before I became a teacher that I got to be, you know, on these kids. You know, it's good time to be for fun, but, you know, when you give a kid an inch, they'll take 3 or 4 miles. I have a great classroom management, and I think that's through my years, because I used to coach sports as well.
Okay.
I coached. I was one of the. Our district's small, so our county's big, but our district was small, and we didn't really have middle school sports. So I'm a middle school teacher, and our district never really made schedules. You know, it's usually like, you know, traveling teams or AAU teams. So I learned when we started actually middle school sports, I was one of the first coaches. And I learned at that point, especially when I had a group of 120 kids for track and field, that I better, you know, have some, you know, some strictness or some stones to, you know, hold off 120 kids at once. And the best athletes of the school at that point. So it's like, I learned from that. If it wasn't that, that was my lessons. My wife, she went to school and did the, you know, the tutors with teaching. She did that where I learned basically by coaching. So I learned there that if, you know, they respect you more if you're not too loosey-goosey is what I feel. And make it interesting. You know, if I want to talk about the Renaissance art, I got to make it worth their while. I got to tell them who my favorite artist is and why, and show them the work to prove why, you know. And same thing goes for any time period, because I'm teaching art history now. And then art 2D, you know, we start basics, and then 3D, we work with clay and things like that. So we start that process over. It's like a wheel. So then I go to, if I start 2D, then 3D, then history, then it'll start over again. So the kids aren't taking the same class over and over again. And what's nice about my school is that I get to teach year round with the same kids, whereas other schools it's semester. So it's like half the year. With a full year, they get so much more out of me. I'm just, you know, giving them so much information and a good digestible chunk so that it doesn't feel rushed. Mm-hmm. So I can work with Renaissance and be with it for like 2.5 to 3 weeks instead of 3 days if I was with a semester course. So I think the kids see that too. They know a confident teacher when they see one, and you know, the new ones that come in that aren't so confident, oh, they'll run straight to the ground pretty much. And the kids know. That's the one thing that everyone thinks, oh, they're just kids. They can't. No, they know. They know. And I love it so much because they challenge me every day. Every day. So I learn something new every day with those kids too, because if I make a mistake in my artwork and I see it and the kid's like, but that looks good. Really? You think so? And then I'll try it again. And then sure enough, it actually works with what I'm trying to show them with what we're teaching them. So, you know, it's fun. And then, you know, I do fun things with them. I do magic tricks and stuff for them for prizes and drawings and, you know, play music. And we have like our end of the week, you know, thing where I ask questions for more prizes and things like that. So I try to make it interesting. I don't want it to be too boring in that class. They only have me for 45 minutes at a time. So, yeah.
Do you think it's good or bad? What do you, the fact that you are making an income from your art, mm-hmm. how do you think that impacts the kids as far as taking the work, your work, seriously?
As
an art teacher.
To me, I think that's very important. If I had a successful art teacher, you know, making money as an artist, like purely based off of their work. Now, I'm in a gray area. I'm drawing licensed characters. So what's good about this, I have to teach them, look, I'm allowed to draw these because I'm on contract. I cannot sell these legally if I were to just draw and then make money off of Spider-Man. Marvel and Disney will come at me. And there's nothing worse than a mad Mickey Mouse. So, you know, I do tell them these things to let them know, look, the reason why I can is because I worked hard to get to it. And now I'm able to draw the characters I know and love. But if I'm successful art teacher and they see me and I can tell them, look, this is what I'm charging. I will tell them what I'm charging. I'm not going to lie to the kids. I'm just going to tell them, this is what I'm charging for my 9x12s. And people are actually paying for that. And they see that I'm successful with that. And it makes them, I feel like, their drive to continue to art, to do art much more, because I didn't have that growing up, and I'm in my mid-30s now, and now I'm starting. If I would have had an art teacher like that when I was younger, I would have started way back, you know, before I even got into the district. So it's one of those things that shoulda, woulda, coulda, you know?
Well, let's talk about that. Going back, what are some of your influences growing up then?
Well, in terms of art, if we talk about art, I wasn't a history buff, but for some reason I was a history buff with art. And you know, the Renaissance were my big Renaissance, and then maybe French Impressionism, mm-hmm. because the idea of dots to look like something, you know, like up close to, you know, it looks like a mess, but far away, wow, it's amazing. You know, those kind of things were my inspiration. And then obviously the comic books, you know, actually I wasn't a big reader. So mine were comic books and graphic novels. So I get the stories by looking at the images. And then the 90s had one of the greatest comic book artists of all time. I mean, and then four of them defected from a major comic book company, five of them, to create their own comic book company. I mean, there's no stories back then except for that in the 90s. You know, it's just like that happened. And then now they're doing their own thing and making, you know, being very successful with what they're doing. You know, so when you're a 90s baby, 80s baby, and you see progression with art in that direction, those were my motivations. You know, Jim Lee's, J. Scott Campbell, you know, they've all made a name for themselves through their specific and unique style of art, and I just love every bit of it. And those were my inspirations, really. Movies are a big one, too. Who's not a Star Wars fan, you know, like, it's very rare to find one that's, I'm going to be honest with you, when I find one, it's like, why? Give me the reasons why. And then I'll understand. I'm not going to argue with you. I'll understand. So, you know, those were my influences, movies, comics, you know, even, I had a few Bible comic books, you know, my parents, they wanted me to be religious and I am to an extent. And then they send me like this, you know, comic books, but in Bible, because they know I'm not going to read the Bible. So they'll give it to me in a graphic novel format. And even those had great artwork and made me want to read the stories. So it's one of those things that my ADHD kicks in and I get too bored and then I just won't read. So then graphic novels, just every page is a surprise. And in this industry, knowing those artists, because I actually didn't just read the stories, I looked at who drew the work as well. And getting to meet them in the conventions is just one of my favorites to meet was Tom Grummett. He did The Death of Superman and The Return of Superman, and obviously stories before that. And then when I heard the story about why they killed Superman, I was just like, you know, and then talking to him about it, when he was so nice enough just to talk to a random guy about, you know, The Death of Superman, The Return of Superman, it made me go on cloud nine. It made me understand why I love this part of the art industry so much, especially for, you know, graphic novels and comic books. But those are my inspirations. You know, I'm not going to lie and say that, you know, give you a few names here and there and that's it. No, I actually have, you know, books here of just all artwork from Jim Lee, from J. Scott Campbell's. I have everything here. They're my references pretty much. And I go back and see their mistakes and learn from their mistakes, because they'll tell you their mistakes. And then I try to implement a little bit of their work. There's a little bit of Jim Lee in my work and a little bit of Tom Grummett in my work with their feathering techniques. So it's not just an inspiration. It's more like my comic book Bible to get the kind of work that I want out. You know what I mean? So
you kind of bring up a pact, and I remember the time when it was Image Comics that mm-hmm. when they kind of went, and McFarlane and company kind of left. And I think although artists had been going back and forth between DC and Marvel for years, I think it was an interesting start to where people would gravitate towards a book, right? You'd go from your heavy hitters, right? You're like, instead of like reading, I'm reading Captain America or I'm reading X-Men. Now I'm reading, I want to see what Todd McFarlane is doing. I want to see what Jim Lee is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting in, because you're almost giving the stories to a certain extent a pass, because I like that artist. And you know, where it's like, you know, it's like these guys come into a point where, you know, at that time that big push in pop culture where it's going up and you know, comics are going all over the place and they're printing them all over, and now you've got cards and things like that. And now it's like, yeah, I'm seeing this particular style. I want to follow this guy. And it's almost like now where, you know, someone might be collecting your, like, I might not be interested in a particular card set, but if I know an artist is in it,
mm-hmm.
that's a bit of a draw to get me over there going, oh, wow. You know, I've got, you know, and once you start knowing and using social media to kind of get yourself out there, you know, now you're not just a name or not just a random pull. You're like, oh, wow. Now I've got this catalog of stuff and I'm going to be in the set. And I'm excited because I know these people are in this set. Even if I like wasn't necessarily interested in the set to begin with, I might go, ooh, I might just want to grab some of that. However I get them, whether I get them off, you know, buy them direct, buy them off secondary market, because yeah. I would like to pull a X card, or I would like to have a piece of that art. Because clearly when you see, if you're trying to do commission work, you know, someone like Carlos, someone like Chris Penix, or, you know, some of these guys, boy, I don't think I could afford them, but boy, if I got pulled them out of a pack, I'd be on in, you know, seventh heaven.
I tried a Neil Adams and I gave up. I ended up buying like one of his sketchbooks and have him sign it. That's all. It was, I even asked, like, I collect sketch cards. So I asked him for a sketch card, and when he told me the price, like, that's what I made in the last, you know, couple of days just working here. I can't do that. You know, it's like, you know, but someone like that, you know, even then you still like, oh, maybe I should, you know, Neil, it's not too often that you run in. Look, I said that to the first time, ran into Neil Adams the first time, I'm like, I'm never going to see this guy again. I should. The next four shows, he was in the same show with me.
Well, that's, you know, I remember, and even, I don't know whether it was this C2E2 or last year, and I want to say you had Chris Claremont, and you had Arthur, was it Arthur Adams? I mean, you had like a combination of artists, and you're going, and there may be a row apart, and of course they had the biggest lines, but then you're kind of going, you know, you see these names growing up, and sometimes, like, you know, later on you kind of go, oh, wow, that's so-and-so, or like, you know, Ronnie Roberts will talk about meeting Jim Lee, and you go, even this year. And I, like I said, now the names are escaping me. As soon as I want to reach for them, they're right there. That's a problem with Grangle. But you kind of go, oh my gosh, I've had this comic of you, or I remember this story, and, you know, and then you go, oh my gosh, I'm meeting the person that drew it. And it was amazing. I had someone sign one of my Star Wars comics earlier this year. Bob McLeod. Yes. Bob McLeod.
Yes.
And you're just like, you just have to take your head off for a moment, because you're going, oh my gosh. And then, you know, they'll tell you a story about it, and then you find out, and you're just like, and then you're right. Then they might be at the same convention next year, and you're going, this is the last time. I'm like, oh, there's again. And then this time they might go, but yeah, Neil Adams would have been an amazing get. But one thing that you kind of mentioned, you were like, you're about the attention span is something maybe I'm picking up in the Instagram feed, where I'm seeing you're taking this style, but you're really attacking all these different characters. I think one of the things that I love about your Instagram page is that I'm seeing people from Friends. I'm seeing, it's like you're picking up and you're going, you know what? Let's try this person. Can you talk about that particular, can you describe that style for me? It's basically a black and white. It's kind of a splotchy. Can you walk me through that? I've been dying to ask you this.
So my method, like Photoshop is the way I do this. So I take an image, I go to Photoshop, and I separate the values of gray. Okay. So I get, and they're off suit every other number. So let's say if I have my Copic markers here, I have a 1, I have a 2, and I have a 4. These are the 3 that I work with the most for my cards. And in Photoshop, I offsuit it to get close to these values of gray in my Photoshop. So what I used to do is I used to spray paint these. I'd buy the 3 values of gray and spray paint, and I would cut the image for each layer so I could spray paint them. That's what graffiti artists normally do. I wasn't a graffiti artist. I never did it on a wall, but I always did it on a canvas, right? I got tired of cutting it. And lo and behold, after I stopped cutting this paper and I figured out how to draw it, and all of a sudden the Cricket comes out. And now I can spray paint them all over because I don't have to cut them anymore. But I was drawing one day, and I actually did it with pencil first, and I separated the values with a pencil. I'm like, I wonder if there was a marker or a paint that I could just do it on a card or on something big. And that's when I got into Copics at that point. And then I realized that it actually looks like a graphic the way I'm drawing it. So if I can stop spray painting it, and I have a few that I still spray paint just so I can, you know, switch it up a little bit. But if I can stop that, I could knock out triple the amount of work in 1 week than I would if I were to cut every layer out. And then, so the idea was, I did this in school. I had done a lesson with kids with graffiti art, and the kids were asking me, hey, what do you do? And then I didn't want to cut everything and show them. So I started drawing it in front of them, like, that's different. I've never seen that before. And then I'm like, ooh, wait a minute, this might work. And then it was a happy accident, honestly. I didn't think it was going to work with markers. Then all of a sudden I tried with gouache, and then I tried with watercolors, and it naturally works, because Photoshop, it does a great job in separating the values of from light to dark on a person. When you figure out how to do like stencil layers on Photoshop, which I learned through YouTube when I was younger, it just naturally progressed to that. And then I've been doing it on cards ever since, and hopefully it pick up as a distinctive style. Now, you mentioned the different people that I draw. It's basically, I would take family members, people that I know, practice with them, sell those. And then it's basically a lot of what I draw is nostalgia, the things that I grew up loving. Now we're doing Rocktober now. So I find a prompt, and then This one was done by a great artist, Tom Hodges, who's a great Star Wars artist within in his own right. This guy's fantastic. And he wrote, put this prompt out, and I said, ooh, can I be a part of this? He said, as long as you tag me and you tag the right things, then yeah, you could do it. So now I'm doing rock stars. So it's like, you know, like, and I'm enjoying it because it's something different. It's great to do comics all the time, but then in movies, but sometimes you want to get to people, you know, just, you know, and find the right likeness of the people and then see how it goes with Photoshop, see if the layers, like that's my struggle, is finding the right image to find the lightness and darkness of the actual person to separate the values. And that's what takes, that actually takes longer for me than to actually draw the card. So if you want to know the exact time, how long it takes for me to draw one of these cards, it's about 15 to 25 minutes. Wow. Per card. And someone actually posted in a Tops, on a Tops page and Facebook this morning, hey, what's the record for most cards done, you know, in a day? And someone actually wrote 45. I was like, oh, that beat me. I was at 25 at one point in the day. And that was like literally working morning to evening and just knocking them out, trying to meet a deadline. And today I finished on the set that I'm working on now. I finished inking all my cards today. So I penciled them first. So what I do is I when I draw it, I do one card fully by itself, so I can feel how the card stock is with the markers and the watercolors, testing it out, you know, because if I make a mistake on one card, it's better than one card than 30 cards. And then I like it, then I start just penciling everything once I have all my, you know, references set. And once I get in that mode, I'm knocking out, you know, about 6 cards, 7 cards a day on a good day. I did try to, you know, go for that record once. It was just too much. But yeah, there are artists out there that can knock out so many in a day, and I feel like I'm one of those that could knock out, you know, 6 to 7 in a day, so I can meet deadlines. My goal is, if I make the deadline within a week's time, they're gonna keep asking me for work. That's what it's about, deadline. And I teach that to my students too. If you don't meet your deadlines, it's just like see the difference between you and me is that I get paid. Your deadline, your payments, your grade. If you learn that now, it's going to be easier for me deadlines in the future. And that's I feel like it's an important life lesson for my students to you know, make sure you meet your deadlines, to make sure you keep your promises. That's the whole point. And if I give them Tops, you know, like, oh, it's due on the 2nd. Oh, I want to get it in there by the 25th, you know, and in their hands by the 25th, they're going to be like, crap, this guy is, all right, what other set can we give this guy? You know, and I don't want to beat out another artist to a job, but yeah, I do. You know, like, I respect all these other artists, but I feel like this is actually helping me, you know, to build a following that people are trusting my speed and my work, the quality. I'm all about the value of the card. So if someone's going to pay me $30 for a card, I'm going to give them $30 worth or more on that card. That's my goal. Because I don't want to be one of those artists that you know, that they get a set and like, ooh, well, he's good, but I don't know. And so I don't want my name to be devalued in that aspect. I want to be reliable.
Going back to, as I was kind of looking over the Rocktober, I still have to fall back on, not Star Wars, but the Aretha Franklin.
No,
off the hook.
Yeah, you liked it? Oh, I was going to say, like, I was actually, I love the list, but there's some people I don't feel like would count as rock stars. I was like, oh, why not Prince? Why not Jimi Hendrix? You know, so I was looking at that and I was like, oh, but then I saw it's a nice little separation. Aretha Franklin's nice, a lot of hits, and the values that I can get out of her references is fantastic. I just finished a Stevie Wonder this morning, or yesterday morning.
I saw that. Stevie is fantastic. And I think the thing that I like, and especially in those two, because they're both smiling, and I think you really capture the joy, especially, you know, in their smiles, in her eyes, you really capture it. And you can really get a sense of the time, because Aretha has such a long, both of them have such a long catalog, but you really capture a time. And yes, you're like I said, like you said, the styles that you did, the Janis Joplin also, how it's offset, and you kind of capture this sort of, it's a slight, you know, whimsical, but also, you know, she seems very like focused or interested in whatever she's looking at. There's an intensity on Bowie, and you really can't go wrong with Bowie. Sort of like, you know, but it's just
Janis was hard because there's not a lot of references with her, you know. So I wanted to make sure that whatever I chose for the image, that it was something that people are going to try to remember, you know, and especially with the likeness of her face, I wanted it. Sometimes I go really close up so that you could really see the features of their face. And then sometimes I pull back so you can get everything else and take it in. It's all depends on my mood and the day, I guess. Sometimes if I feel like I'm not so stressed out and I got time, I kind of like look through my references a lot more and then looking for that specific thing that catches my eye. If I'm kind of quick and speedy, like the ones that with the groups, I mean, they're great to look at, like the Beatles, I think I did the Who as well, and all those, like, they're great and they're fun. Oh, and the
Rolling Stones
and Black Sabbath, they're great, but there's so many. Like I could have knocked out like 6 or 7 sketch cards, and that one took me about almost the same amount as like 6 or 7 sketch, because it's a bigger card stock that I'm working with, and it's larger and I'm using a lot more ink. So those take longer for me because there's 4 in one shot. Whereas Stevie, that was about a 20-minute, 30-minute, you know, sketch. And I really wanted to capture that. He always does this thing where when he sings, he's always looking up and his mouth is always open and he's, you know, always swaying side to side. So I wanted to capture that jawline going up. And that's the only way I see Stevie in my mind. I really wanted to make Ozzy Osbourne look youthful. I really wanted to find a youthful look to Ozzy Osbourne because that when his Black Sabbath started out, when I read about it, because I still read about these things, and there's so much life and so much energy, and I wanted to portray that with the group. I mean, they're technically the first, in my mind, the first hard rock band that kind of gave you that gothic style was that band. So I wanted to get the blacks in there and making sure that it's all in there. I try to stay away from logos. I didn't want to tarnish the image with logos either. So I could have put the Black Sabbath logo, and then every time I try that idea, it's just, it makes the image look bad to me.
I have to think with these, you know, I think less is more. And I think the more you put into it, I think you don't get as much. Whereas I do think with Stevie, yeah, like I said, I the simplicity of just the colors that you're, you know, the grays that you're working with, you know, and if you're getting it, you know, once you kind of get, you know, the eyes and some of that, the rest of it is really gravy at that point.
Yeah.
The Elvis also very nice.
Eyes are the hardest because it makes or breaks. It makes or breaks. It's one of those things that the hardest person to draw, and I kid you not, I've been struggling with this girl for the longest time, Natalie Portman. She's the hardest person for me to draw, and the reason why is because she has the every woman face. If you mess up on an eyebrow, because she has straight eyebrows, if you mess up on her eyebrows, it doesn't look like her. If you mess up on her eyes, it doesn't look like her. Her jawline, there's all so distinguished features on Natalie Portman. I struggle with her the most. So I try not to do as much Padmes for the Star Wars sets. So if you see a Padme in those sets from me, then that's one of the rare ones that I draw, because I try to stay away from her as much as possible because I can't seem to get her right. Even with the best reference photos, it's just one little offline, it takes so much. And I'm also working through my phone too, so I'm looking at my phone and then I'm drawing them, like I do the grid method on the cards, and that takes a little time. But even with the grid method, I still can't get her. I have one here and it irks me because she's so hard to draw. I think I can show this one because everyone knows Master, which is coming anyways. Just to get her to look at her, And I'm still not happy with it. It's one of those things, like, I think I got her chin and I think I got her eyes and, you know, like, it's her straight eyebrows, you know, like, it's what makes her her. You know, you want to make sure you get it right. And she's the hardest. Luke, the easiest. Mark Hamill is just, I could draw him with a different size nose and it'll still look like Mark Hamill, no matter what. His hair, the way his hair flows, all that, it's just, it's one of those things that my kids see me draw Natalie Portman. Like, and I'm practicing because I practice sometimes when I know it's a tough character to draw. I practice, and they're my best critics. Mr. Irvine, no, that doesn't look like.
Well, who then, you know, Luke is easy, Padme is hard, but who do you love drawing?
With Star Wars?
Yeah.
It's Rey. Rey's right now, there's every photo that I've seen of her is just like an iconic pose. Like, no matter what she does, like, she's always like serious and the eyes are intense. So I could easily say the Mandalorian as well. Or any guy wearing a Mandalorian outfit because they're fun to draw, but Rey's right now the number one for me because it's every image that I draw of her is so intense, and you see the emotion that she conveys, and to me that's a testament of her acting. I mean, I mean she might not be the greatest actress in the world, but with what she got with the Star Wars, I mean I think she knocked it out of the park for her character. With depending on how you feel with the new trilogy or not, you know, I'm not a big fan of the new trilogy, but I like her in it, and I like, you know, the original cast that came in and reprised the roles. So, yeah, she's my favorite. I know, Han Solo was great at one point. I like drawing old Han. I like it. It's fun. He has this aesthetic to his demeanor that he is the tough guy no matter what. Maybe even out of camera he's like that too. You know, so he's fun to draw too.
Well, that, speaking of which, you know, since you kind of grew up in the 90s, that probably puts you, where does it put you for the prequels? Does that kind of, is that your Star Wars?
I'm gonna be honest, the first two, the only thing I liked about the second one was when Yoda started fighting Dooku. Even though that was completely CG, I thought that was, you know, that was the only experience I got from Star Wars where everyone got out of their seat, you know, with Yoda's fighting, you know, like everyone. Revenge of the Sith is one of my favorites. That 15, 20 minute long lightsaber battle between the two was just, I mean, perfectly choreographed. They even mentioned that's their speed, that they didn't augment the speed of their swinging at all. So, Revenge of the Sith, as a whole, the story, probably not. The original trilogy is to me, the best. I think it's because there is an actual story that it all fit together. You know, it just made sense. It ended well. And the second trilogy, or the prequels, the ending was great. Except for the Vader no sequence. But other than that, the Revenge of the Sith was a good one. The new ones were great to get new fans. That's all I can say with that. They're great to get new fans. I felt like they could have done better. I think that if they would have had Dave Filoni as heading Star Wars, I think we would have seen a different Star Wars if they had Dave Filoni. Dave Filoni is the reason why the Clone Wars were fantastic. And he's also one of the reasons why, with him and the guy who directed Iron Man, Jon Favreau, Mandalorian is fantastic as well. So he's only done a few things, two to three things, and they're better than the last trilogy in my mind. But people do love it, and I respect them for loving it, and you know, it keeps the line going, you know. And then everything that you get out of it, you know, like Galaxy's Edge and things like that, you know, it's just when you step in that place, I don't know if you've been there yet. It's I wanted to stay the whole week just there.
What do you
that place got my kids liking Star Wars. It wasn't the movies. It was the location that my daughter got to pilot the Millennium Falcon. And she's like, Daddy, let's do that again. I love it. And then I'm like, there's a movie we could watch. He's like, really? No more Frozen? All right.
That's awesome. How long does it take to get you to get from the Naples area to Orlando? About an hour?
3.5 hours. Yeah. To get from let's say if you're in Miami to Orlando, you probably get there in 2.5 hours because it's closer to the other side of the state. It's not right in the middle. Everyone thinks it's right in the middle of the state. It's kind of leaning more closer towards the east. Me, I have to go up north and then try to find a middle road to split between 75 to I-4. So if I take 75 to I-4, it'll take close to 4 hours. Whereas if I take go up the middle of the state, it'll take me about 3.5. It's actually a nice drive, though. Florida's big, so it takes 8 hours to get out of here driving. So unless you're going through Tallahassee and heading west, it takes longer that way. But it's not bad, especially when it's something new for the kids to see and new for the family to see at the same time. It's a nice long enough getaway, but not too far where it's just going to be a pain in the butt.
Oh, that's true. Now, how many times have you been to Galaxy's Edge?
I've only been there once because the reason why is because COVID hit in March. We were actually there the weekend they decided to close down Disney. So that Friday we were what park were we? We were in Galaxy's Edge that Friday. That was the last park. We were supposed to stay till Saturday and make a family day and go to Downtown Disney or Disney Springs. But that Saturday morning, that's when they said we're shutting everything down Monday. If they're shutting everything down, even though we have an extra day, I said my wife's like, we need to go, you know, for safety reasons. And then Disney was great giving us our refund for the day, you know. And we didn't have any tickets, so we didn't have to worry about that. So we just went straight home. But I did enjoy the time we were in Galaxy's Edge. It took so long because we Floridians know that when something new pops up in Disney or in Universal, don't go. Everyone wants to go. Don't go. So we wait a year. The ones that actually do go, we sometimes wait a year unless you live in the Orlando region. If you live in the Orlando region and you have the year-round passes, you know, I have friends that do that, and they go anytime they want. They go during the weekdays if they want to. Us, you know, since it's a 3.5-hour drive, we wait till it kind of dies down, and then we go. So I still haven't written. When we got there, I tried to do that lottery system to get into the new ride that opened up. I think it was last February,
which Rise is of the Resistance.
So that was almost impossible. I hate the lottery system. You could be. We were there. I kid you not, like 5 a.m, waiting in that long line. Then the park opened up an hour early. We get in about 8. Still had to wait till 9 o'clock when the park opened to do the lottery. So, and they only have maybe one or two copy shops open, and you're still like waiting. But once it dies down a little bit, I can't wait to ride that ride. The Millennium Falcon was fantastic. Even the Blue Milk, I loved it. My kids drank it. You know, I made a few lightsabers. I tinker, so I also make a few props as well. And so seeing them there, Disney licensed pieces and you know, the actual Star Wars lightsabers, you know, makes you want to buy one. But you know, it's just nice to see it. Like you feel like you're part of it. They're not making it like a gimmick. It's more like, I mean, some lady was picking up the trash can in a costume, and she was still in character. That just changed it for me. And once they make the hotel, oh man, once they make that hotel, it's going to be a new experience there. I think it's going to be very expensive, but you know, I can't wait for people to start putting photos and videos about that because that's going to look fantastic.
What are some of the shows you're looking forward to the most coming up, and maybe even from a artistic perspective of characters to maybe attack?
Ghostbusters. I'm a big Ghostbuster. I'm actually a bigger Ghostbuster fan and Power Ranger fan than I am of Marvel. I'm a 90s kid, 80s kid. Power Rangers were a cheesy show, but I loved every second of it, the original 3 seasons. And so if I ever get a Power Ranger gig, I'm in it. A Ghostbuster gig, I'm in it. Cryptozoic actually had a run of sketch cards with Ghostbusters a few years back. And this was before I started, and I was hoping and praying that they would do it again. So I'm hoping that if the Afterlife, once it comes out in March, that they're going to do a set for that. And I already sent them a message already. Please, please, I want this one. I will not let you down.
What about Star Wars? What are you kind of looking forward to coming up?
Mandalorian. It's a couple weeks now. So Mandalorian, I think that's... I heard that they're probably going to do like a few like offshoot side stories, but I don't... Until I know more about it, I'm not going to get excited until I see trailers or things. The Mandalorian, I was actually hesitant because the Solo was a good... decent movie for someone that never seen Star Wars, but for someone that's seen Star Wars, I did not like Solo. So I like the actors. The actors are fantastic. I you know, having the Queen of the Dragons to be in that movie was fantastic. But I didn't like that movie. I didn't like the direction. So I was hoping that if Mandalorian went that direction, I probably wouldn't have liked it. But it blew my mind. That's a fantastic show. And so if the next stuff that comes out is going to be like that, then yeah, I'm excited for it. But there's really nothing out there right now that's... yeah, I think the COVID crisis just put a halt to everything. So until we get, you know, more news, probably in 2021, you know, I'm not really that excited except for Ghostbusters right now.
Well,
let's just say it might be a bad movie. But I feel like it's in good hands. The son, Ivan Reitman's son, Jason, is the director. They're actually staying within the timeline. I actually like the Girl movie. I actually did like it. A lot of people will hate my guts for saying that. I did like it because I'm a fan of those comedians. Those women are fantastic. So, you know, whether you love them or hate them, you know, there's some mean fan people out there. But I actually loved it. You know, I watch it with the kids. The kids love it too, especially my girls who they get to look up to, you know, women fighting ghosts, you know, Frozen, you know, Disney's been doing good. You know, Sony did good with that. But you know, it's a shame that they're not going to have their next movie because of the fan backlash. But, Bill and Ted was fantastic. And maybe it's because it's the only new thing that came out in a while. But the Bill and Ted third movie, I actually liked it. It was decent. It was funny enough. It felt like a Bill and Ted movie. So that was good. I did something for Bill and Ted. I entered in their poster contest. So that was fun. So I got to do a 9x12 and do something different. So it's, again, hitting the nostalgia. I like drawing things that I loved growing up watching, you know. Every now and then I'll start practicing doing figure drawings and ink drawings and things like that, washes, work with values, things that I learned in college. You know, they'll show us videos mostly of people doing different techniques. And then we'll get the occasional person just standing there. All right, draw them now. Do you like is there anything you're looking forward to? Like, are you looking forward to anything Star Wars coming up?
I would have to say that I think the Mandalorian really did, you know, it came in with almost no expectations and really knocked it out of the park. And I think that there was a little something in that everybody in the family got on. And that's what I liked about it. I liked where, you know, people didn't necessarily have to know the whole thing or, you know, the backstory of everything, but they could pick up on it. And I think it had a good story and throughput. And, you know, at the end, you know, like I said, it was really like, this is amazing what you can do.
Yeah.
I'm concerned. I'm only concerned because, you know, I think there's so many more expectations for the second season. And I think people, much like everything else, they'll start kind of hanging their coats on this coat rack. And, you know, it kind of maybe buries what they're trying to do. But I do have to agree with you that I think that, you know, I think Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau can tell a story. And, you know, I think all you have to do is watch that one gallery episode where in about 2 minutes, it's the one, you know, the famous that bit where Filoni basically just drops the whole prequels thing on you. And everybody's like, oh, wow, I had no idea. Like, you're just like, all right, Sensei just basically just racked my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting.
that loves the material should be a big head of the actual material. That's all. I mean, I don't know much about George Lucas's appointee. I forget her name. Kathleen Kennedy. I mean, I obviously she's a big producer and she's done a lot of things. But I'm not going to hate her for it. You know, she's doing the best with what she can. But if you have someone like Dave that just absolutely loves it and it can actually create stories that would make sense for the universe, that's the one that should head the whole thing.
Well, and it's also interesting that, you know, even though you had different directors, you did have a throughput. So I think you had a vision, but you had different points of view and you know, and there was a diversity of thought on it that I think really, you know, I think they got a really good product. And you know, it's tough when you go from having someone with a solo vision, even if they have other people help, to having it, you hate to say by committee, but you know, it's a lot different than just George pushing, you know, through sheer will of force. But at the end of the day, you know, as someone that's a little older and you go, it's still Star Wars to me, whether or not they succeeded. I was just watching the original Boba Fett cartoon from the holiday special. It came up because the Talking Bay 94 fella, the podcast, talked to the animator. And I hadn't seen it. Well, I went back and I'm like, that really holds up. And, you know, it's a very distinctive, they were looking for a very distinctive, you know, art style. They're looking for that heavy metal magazine type art style. And the animation was very fluid. And you kind of go back going, and you kind of forget going, oh yeah, that's right. They had the voices. And so you're like, this was a nice solid little piece of Legends. And you get, you know, and then you see, you know, when you go back to the Mandalorian, you go face, you know, fast forward back to the Mandalorian where they pick up the rifle and they pick up these little bits where, to the average person, it doesn't get in their way, or they don't have to know that that weapon's there, but you go, so it's, you just give this something for everybody. And so that's where, you know, you would hope that, you know, maybe Star Wars is TV now. I'm Star Wars now. But, you know, I think when they do films again, you know, I always want to see, like, I just recently saw Empire Strikes Back. They released it in a theater again. I took my daughter. And it was amazing to see, and there's still details I was missing. I've seen this movie, you know, dozens of times, and you go, oh, okay, because I'm watching it on a big screen, you can, oh, okay, there's that, and there's that droid there, and that, you're just going, and so you're still getting stuff out of it. So you're still, Star Wars is still a big screen experience, but the story has just as much to do with it as the, you know, the laser swords and the things blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to get to introduce your children to it, and, it, you know, they'll grow up either liking it or not. You know, you can give it to them. You can give them the toys. You can do all the stuff. And if they pick up on something and go with it, it's great. You know, it's like, you know, if your daughter's, hey, it's just, oh, I got to pilot the Falcon. This is great. There's a movie to it. Even better.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you can really hope for. Something that I can go, you know, I came back from Five Below. I went to Five Below and cause of all the toys, and I brought her back some socks. I'm like, you know, like socks are too small for me, but I can enjoy them and you can wear them and enjoy them. So it's sort of like, Daniel, where can people find you online if they want to reach out or maybe do a commission?
So at Dan Sketch Art is my Instagram and Facebook handle. That's the best way to get in touch with me. I do answer my DMs there and I will talk to you pricing wise and what it is exactly that you want me to draw. And I communicate very well with that. That's pretty much the only place. I do have an Etsy page, but there it's only two things up there. It's basically like custom commissions. So it's either an 8x8.5x11 or 9x12 down to a sketch card. So 2x3.5 and you can get me through there as well. But I've gotten the most DMs through Instagram right now.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and you know, like I said, I wish you all the best. Once again, that's one of the nice things about Instagram is that, you know, with artists, you can really see your stuff. You can really keep out there, and you keep connection with fans and with the community, just like in some of the other groups. So once again, just appreciate you being on.
No, I really appreciate you. This has been fun, fantastic. I'm honored to be in this podcast. So I really would like to thank you for having me be part of it.
Can I offer you a libation? to celebrate the closing of our shared narrative.
Once again, my thanks to Daniel for being on the program tonight. It was an absolute treat to get a chance to talk with him and find out more about his work. I really hope you enjoyed tonight's show. And if you have any feedback for the episode, you can reach out to the program in a number of ways. You can leave a comment on the Instagram post for this episode, or you can DM me on Instagram at RebelBaseCard. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook at RebelBaseCard, or email the program, greg@rebelbasecard.com. You can find the show notes for this and all episodes on the website, RebelBaseCard.com. In a Star Wars card trader app and, well, just about any other app, it's CornFed Tech. I use the hashtag Card Squadron, not only for a way to put out the words on cool cards and card collecting, but as a way, hopefully, to bring the community a little closer together. We collect, communicate, and commiserate when we run out of credits and crystals to spend in the app. Join in on the fun. Plus, well, all the other cool squadrons were already taken by Star Wars squadrons. Yep, I'm playing too. We collect as one, and would be honored if you would join us. And if you were a sketch card artist or Star Wars artist or collector, cosplayer, and want to talk about your work, your craft, your passion, please drop me a line and maybe we can work something out. I'd love to get a chance to hear your story. You can also help out the program by leaving a comment and review on iTunes or wherever you get this podcast from. Otherwise, I implore you, keep those cards out of the hands of the Empire, and I'll talk to you soon.
The music for this podcast is brought to you under a Creative Commons license from Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails. This is Discipline off the album The Slip.
This podcast is not affiliated in any way with Topps, Disney, or Star Wars, nor is it endorsed by Disney or Lucasfilm, and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. All names and sounds, and any other related items, are properties of their respective trademarks and/or copyright holders here in the U.S. and abroad. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com.